This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity. Tom's clients include over 700 of the world's top brands, including names like Garmin, The North Face, Dillard, Under Armour, REI, and Dyson. Experticity helps these companies foster deeper connections with their customers. They do this by educating what they call product experts and brand advocates who are in a position to influence sales. Prior to Experticity, Tom was CEO of Ancestry.com. He was president of Ticketmaster.com and was a general manager of City Search, one of the internet's early success stories. Tom, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
My pleasure.
So let's start with Experticity. I kind of laid the groundwork, but tell us more. What does Experticity do?
So Experticity is really pioneering a category. And so I'm going to tell the story of the notion of it rather than try and describe what kind of company it's like exactly. But the reality is you and I, as consumers, we're paying less and less attention to marketing. We fast forward over the commercials on our DVRs. We ignore the parts of our computer screen that we think are dedicated to advertising. We have ad blocking technology. The fact is, no human is saying, oh, please market to me some more. Can I get some more of that? We're all trying to get past it. And even when marketing works, driving down the road, you see a billboard for Saucony, you don't think, oh, I'm going to buy that pair of shoes. You think, I need to buy a pair of shoes. What should I be thinking about? And you start saying, okay, Saucony and maybe Asics and Adidas and Altra, maybe I've heard about these. What should I be thinking about? You buy something confidently when you talk with someone that you trust. They're the right blend of expertise and authenticity. It's not your perception that they're trying to sell you anything. They just want you to have a better life. They want you to run more and enjoy running. And when you talk with that person, interact with that person, or when you read a review by that person online, you go from, oh yeah, I need a pair of running shoes, to that is the pair I'm going to buy. That's going to be perfect for me. That's the way commerce really works. But there isn't, until us, there isn't a company that would help all of us take advantage of that real dynamic. There's no way for a company like Saucony to tap into the thousands and thousands of people who are super passionate about running, obsessed with the details of what's going on in the category, spend way too much of their money on running shoes. They have a dozen pair of shoes sitting in their closet, and they do it constantly. They're constantly trying to explore with it and all. They're inspiring. They inspire the rest of us to go get more out of running. And we are building great big networks of those passionate people in categories from running to cooking to photography to pets that all of us turn to for guidance about confidently buying and getting the most out of that stuff.
So I can see where it'd be a really powerful channel for brands.
Yeah.
I can also see where, and thus here's the business, it's also difficult to aggregate those fans. How do you identify those folks that are passionate about the brands and then aggregate them in a way that it's useful for a big brand?
Yeah. Yeah. That is at the core of really what we do that creates a unique offering. And it turns out that these people, as I said, they exist. They've always existed. But how do you aggregate them? How do you pull them into one place? Well, you have to find out what motivates them. You have to find out where are they likely to be. I'll say about myself, my LinkedIn profile, for example, says a lot about me as a guy who's tried to build internet-based companies. It says nothing about me as a bike nut. But I am a bike nut. I'm obsessed. I read way too much about what the latest trends in technology are.
You even ride
are.
Your bike in the winter.
I even ride
That's
my bike.
Obsessed.
I am obsessed. I spend way too much money on bikes. I love to do it all the time. And so what we've done with Experticity is figure out how to appeal to someone like me and what are the bits of evidence about someone like me that make me someone you might want to rely on or seek out for advice about what to buy in a bike. And we give experts then the right rewards, the right recognition, the right special access for the value they provide. And so we do everything from find someone who works in a specific place. So do you work at a bike shop? that might be an indication you're someone who's sought out for advice about bikes, someone who is incredibly engaged in the category. If you regularly win events and you sign up for lots of competitive events in the year, it's not that you're a Greg LeMond or a professional cycler, but you're constantly at it and people know that about you, that might be an indication that you like to share pictures and things of your biking activity and your biking adventures. That might be indicative. We just assemble that kind of evidence and then we give those people special access to the brand, special access to information and a chance to buy directly from the brand.
And talk to me about the connection with the brand. What kind of tools are you giving the brands to more effectively reach out and educate those fans?
Yeah, so we're saying to the brand, hey, you know that what you were doing in marketing not long ago isn't working as well, and that anything that's perceived as inauthentic or just being thrown out there, people are turning away from, let us help you tap into the real authentic people and the conversations they're having, and let us help you make those conversations better. So we'll say to a brand, again, going back to the running analogy, we'll say to a brand, hey, we have hundreds of thousands of people in our network who are these obsessive, nutty fans, advocates about running. We'll help you get in front of those people. We'll help you make them smarter and more articulate about your brand. We'll help you get them experience with your product, product seed and things like that. And we'll make all of that really tangible and trackable for you.
And you know, it seems to me from your company standpoint that you have this asset of a group of fans, and I'm just going to use that term for, if there's a better term you want me to use, let me know. But you've got this group of fans that are interested in running. That's an asset to the company, and it's an asset not just to one shoe brand, but probably to multiple shoe brands.
Yeah.
Do you offer your services to competing brands, and do they share the same advocates, or how do you think about that issue?
We call these people, they are influential, and we don't get hung up that much about exactly what the word to describe them, but you know who they are. They are the people you're seeking out for advice, and they are really influential. And we do. So, for example, 9 of the top 10 brands in running are our clients.
They're tapping into the same base of fans. The fans are running fans, not per se Nike fans or a specific New Balance.
Some of them are New Balance fans. Some of them are Asics fans. Some of them are Saucony fans. Some of them are, but they are more fundamentally, they're running fans. The real key to the value for you and me as a consumer and for our brand clients is the authenticity. And the point is, there is no such thing as a runner who only likes one brand head to toe. And even if you knew everything about, and you're an incredible fan of Asics, I'll make it up. Part of what helps you be that fan is that you know Saucony and Adidas and Nike. You know why what you love is different. And so you love to study about it. You love to know what the trends are. And frankly, typically these people are not brand blind. They love the product they love because it's exceptional for them. And if one day they woke up and the product weren't exceptional anymore, they would switch in a heartbeat. They're not.
And that's what makes them authentic.
That's exactly right.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity. So, you know, one of the things I like about the Experticity story is the pieces all make sense. And often when a company starts, there's these nuggets of brilliance, this nuggets of wow, you can change the world, but there's also pieces of that model that feel like they don't fit. It's not this virtual circuit that builds on itself. As I listen to the Experticity story, both here today and what I've heard in the past, it's all gelling very nicely, and that takes time. You joined the company, I think, in 2010.
Yep.
As CEO, what was that cycle like then, and what were some of the pieces that you said, you know, we have to rethink a couple of these parts?
So a really interesting company already existed, and the purpose of the company was to educate retail salespeople. And the company was obsessive about, are we going to create material that really does make someone a better recommender. But what we realized one day was, wait a second, the person who would spend half an hour getting smarter about ASICs, they're already different. We didn't just make them smarter. They showed us that they already were more passionate about running and ASICs by virtue of interacting. And then we also made them smarter. And it was this notion that, are we focused on being an education resource, a training type company, an online education, or are we focused on building out networks of the people that all of us trust for advice? And what's a characteristic of those people? They're obsessed with details. They crave knowledge. They want to know that what they're recommending is worth recommending. And that transition hasn't been easy and isn't easy. It's easy to articulate, but it doesn't magically happen. And
that's where I'm going with this, because that's where leadership comes in, right? You can see where you need to evolve.
Yeah.
But not everybody shares that vision day one.
Yeah. Well, and in fact, and you got back to this thing about words and notions and these people. And it's interesting to me, there's this whole field in marketing right this minute that's called influencer marketing. And it's hot because people do recognize that traditional forms of advertising and broadcast marketing are working less and less well. People aren't ignoring them. And so, hey, let's tap into influencer marketing. But even influencer marketing, done wrong, is done really wrong. There, for example, there's a recent campaign where LeBron James is the spokesperson for the Kia 900. Well, no one believes LeBron James.
He doesn't even fit into a Kia.
So much so, by the way, that there's a funny other commercial recently where LeBron James is saying, "No, really, I do." it's comical to me. But the point they're missing is that real influence, genuine influence, happens because of authenticity. And at some level, authenticity, you can't fake authenticity at scale, right? Just because someone has 1 million followers, if they say something that isn't authentic, you just broke the whole thing. You just broke the whole thing. Authenticity happens in little bits, person to person, a person who is genuinely passionate about something, saying they really believe something they really believe in. And that person has to be someone you can relate to. If I were to say, I'm not going to do a good job on continuing the running theme, but snowboarding, you know, it's not that Sean White is going to actually influence the snowboard purchase I would make that much, even though he's super, he's Sean White. He's the ultimate snowboarder. But can I really relate to that? Is the thing he's going to say, is he really saying it because he's getting paid to say it? Is he really saying it because it works perfectly for him, but it wouldn't work at all for me? I don't know. What I want to do is I want to tap into the person who for me is just the right amount. Again, that balance of expertise and authenticity that's aspirational enough for me that I get confidence and inspiration out of that recommendation.
You know, that's a worthy goal.
Yeah.
But it also likely forces your company to make difficult decisions occasionally.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What happens in the network when an influencer that was authentic is starting to lose that authenticity? Is that person gets to stay in the program? Do you have to boot them out? How do you handle that?
It's interesting. We would boot them out, but actually we don't have to do that very much. We're not directly compensating these people. These people aren't doing it because they are making money. The incentives and the goals line up. These people who are appropriately authentic are getting the right set of things out, the right reward set, the right balanced approach. So, for example, going back to the running shoe example, we're not saying that if you recommend Saucony, you're going to get a better set of rewards than if you recommend Adidas. For example, we're saying you're going to recommend what you recommend. Each of these companies is working like mad to create a great product for some market segment they've targeted. They know you're being asked for your advice all the time about running, and they want you to know the truth and the depth about their product. And that's what we're trying to facilitate. And then we're going to give you special access to that brand. You're going to know things that they're working on. You're going to be able to buy directly from them, those kinds of things.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity. You know, earlier we were talking about this cycle, and what I like is how the pieces all build on each other. You are a platform that's taking hundreds of impressive brands and connecting them, I'm guessing, to hundreds of thousands of folks on your platform.
Yeah.
The brands are an important part of your business.
Oh, of course.
The fans are an important part of your business. I can see how you foster the relationship with the brands, right? That's traditional business development and relationships. How do you foster relationships with hundreds of thousands of fans? How do you keep them in the loop and wanting to participate in this system?
Yeah, we work on that all the time, and we'll keep improving that for a long, long time. It turns out they have the right incentives to engage with us. They want to know what's going on. They want to know the leading edge technologies. They want to know the innovations. They want to have a special relationship with these brands where their voices are more respected. They know what's coming. They know the trends, those kinds of things. And they can, when they are being asked for advice, which they are all the time, you ask these people, do people come to you and ask you for advice about this stuff? Oh my gosh, yes, all the time, they will tell you. They want to have the right bits of information to make great recommendations. Because at the end of the day, really, they get their biggest reward when that person that they made a recommendation to comes back and says, oh my gosh, I love those shoes you told me about. They've totally changed. I now love running, for example. So they have a motivation to keep coming in and keep trying to understand what's the most up-to-date thing, what brands can they have a connection with. All of those motivations on their part give us a great fertile ground to provide them rich, exciting, interesting ways to connect both with the brands and then with each other.
So, you know, I know that another platform company that's been wildly successful, Airbnb.
Yeah.
You know, they'll actually host events throughout the world for the folks that are putting their rooms up for rent,
yeah.
Who are the Airbnb host. Do you do anything like that? Do you have an annual, hey, let's get together and have a good time, and this is what Experticity is all about?
In fact, we have them all over the place in little ways, and we're getting better and better. But just now at OR, for example, we had a great big gathering here in Salt Lake for the Outdoor Retailer Show, which happens twice a year here. It's a gathering of hundreds of the brands that build the coolest outdoor products that we love. If you're the kind of person who likes to walk into an REI or a sporting goods shop.
Well, I'll add you to my list of people that I pester to try to get a pass because the public just can't go. You need to know somebody.
No, so. but if
I'll add you to my list of people I know hoping to get a pass next year.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, think about the dynamics. The people who do have passes to get into OR, guess what? They're asked for their advice all the time about what to buy because they're industry insiders. Anyway, we hosted a big fun event with those people, and they are inspiring. Part of what makes this company just so fun is that these people who get that passionate about some kind of activity, they're fun to be around. Truly, they are trying to, they want you to love the thing they love just a fraction as much as they love it. They can't help but tell their stories about some adventure they've had or some new thing they've tried or something you've got to try. They're just fun to be around.
You know, that's part of what makes learning a new sport. That's part of the fun of learning a new sport is hooking up with these influencers, hooking up with these experts, the ones that take the time, take you under their wing. That's part of it. It's the community aspect.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's fundamental to why those people, those influencers, those experts, find it rewarding. They love it as much as you do.
Now, how much of Expertisity's fan base is still in the retail, which was the roots of the company?
Yeah, roughly half. It keeps evolving, but it's interesting to think, again, just the people who are listening to this who are these experts, if they think back in their lives, an enormous number of them will have had a job in retail sometime during their life in that category. Like if you're the guy who loves skiing, you might have worked at the ski resort or in a ski shop sometime during your life.
Funny you say that. We interviewed Bob Wheaton, who's the president of Deer Valley, a couple months ago. And I'm coming up on my 10th season being a part-time ski instructor.
Yeah.
There, I kind of view it as my volunteer job.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, when you live in Park City and you live in a state like Utah, skiing's a big part of it. It's a way for me to get into a different community that would have otherwise been difficult to get into. And it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, and I can tell you for sure, if you're that guy, you found a way to make it a bigger, like a structural part of your life.
In fact, I think you guys also run ProForm, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, exactly right.
Exactly. And there's another ProMotive.
ProMotive.
Yeah, which targets ski instructors.
That's exactly right.
I get your stuff and get some wonderful discounts every now and then. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And you are the type of person that then winds up on the platform, and you are the type of person who is regularly asked for your advice either directly or because someone sees you standing there at the lift and they go, well, if that guy is wearing that stuff and he works here, that must be the right stuff. That's why those brands are excited to have that relationship with you. And that's probably why you sought that job out a little bit.
No, it all makes sense. You know, you and I have known each other about 2 decades, kind of socially. I went to business school a couple years after you did, and we're all here in Utah.
Yeah.
When I first heard, the Tom Stockham I knew when I first moved to Utah was this internet genius. lots of successes, and we're going to...
It's a totally different Tom Stockham,
obviously. We're going to talk about that path, but as I mentioned in the open, some big internet brand names you helped develop and help pioneer in the early day. And when I first heard you were going to this company, at the time I thought of it more as a retail channel. I thought, well, maybe that's the next disruption, right? You'd been taking stuff in the physical world and disrupting them on the internet, and now you were kind of taking stuff on the internet and looking to disrupt in the physical space. Was that how you looked at it initially, or was the physical retail component, which can be difficult to scale, was that a hindrance when you initially looked at the company?
Your broader point that there is this disruption reality of what we have observed happening on the internet that should be happening in the whole real world. How could you build a company to help make that happen? That is exactly right. The retail thing, you know, I would say about retail in general that for a long time, retailers focused almost exclusively on offering low prices and broad selection. And wow, we've all benefited as consumers because of that. I'm not saying those are bad things. It's
that was
amazing.
Big box store. 20, 30 years
that's
ago.
Exactly right. Staples. And then Amazon is a similar thing. It's like the ultimate in price comparison and all. But I will tell you that only drives a fraction of what's good about any buying experience. I want to buy confidently. I want to buy the thing. I don't need a recommendation about toilet paper, probably. Consumer packaged goods or processed food, I probably don't need someone to guide me. But a camera, a nice set of cooking knives, some cosmetics that are pretty expensive, a pair of skis, I want to interact with someone I trust who they're not trying to sell me something. They don't have ulterior motives. They're just trying to help me make a great decision for me. Why can't that happen at scale? Why can't that happen just like that instantly? Let's fix that.
It was your first introduction to the company. I know you did some angel investing and some board memberships. And at the time, you were not sure you wanted to jump back into an operating role. It's very intense. It's very time-consuming. Was your first involvement with the company from an advisor, investor standpoint, or were you always looking at it as this might be a fun company to lead?
No, it was at first an advisor investor, and a great company founded by a guy, Paul Kerwin, up in Park City, and just all of lots of good things, even in its earliest days. But it was a few years in that it became really clear to me that there was a transform commerce idea, asset, company that was possible. And that's when I got involved.
And talk to us about that decision. We're going to transition here next to some of your other companies that you did. But what made you think, you know what, I want to go back. I do want to do another operating position.
I love building things. Like the absolute deepest reward I get out of anything is really building something. And by the way, I love building a shed or a set of Legos with my son. But a company is a deeply rewarding building process. And as an advisor to a company, you can get a lot. It's interesting. But the most core rewards that come out of really building something aren't there. I think you've heard me say before, you know, when I was mostly an advisor, I would say, well, it doesn't come with the deep rewards of solving the really big problems and pushing them over the line. That's the bad part. The good part is it doesn't come with the big problems either. As an advisor, you don't really have to shoulder and take on problem solving. But most of really building something is just a constant barrage of knocking down problems, solving one after the other. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I love it. I love it. So I feel privileged to get to do this and work on it. And it's not that there aren't other great balances in life. Building a company is intense. You don't get to spend as much time.
It's all or nothing.
Yeah. You don't get to spend as much time doing other things, but I love it.
That concludes the first part of my interview with Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity. Join us again next week to hear the rest of the conversation. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear my entire interview with Tom on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is The Bottom Line. I'm Ross Chambliss, sitting in for Doug Wells. Today, we continue our conversation with Tom Stockham, the CEO of the Salt Lake City-based company Experticity. Prior to leading Experticity, Stockham was CEO of Ancestry.com, the president of Ticketmaster.com, and a general manager of City Search, one of the internet's early success stories. But Stockham has acknowledged that his early business endeavors have not always been so fruitful. Doug asked him about these experiences.
Tell us about your first experience going out to raise money and trying to build a company.
Yeah, so I have always aspired from the time I was a teenager to be the business builder of technology companies. And in business school, I had what I believed was an enormous idea, change what was then the video rental business. There were companies like Blockbuster and Hollywood Video and all these things. And I would go in, any consumer would go in, and you'd go in on Friday afternoon for a video you wanted that day. And inevitably, nothing that you thought you wanted to see was there. And the notion was, well, what if these stores, instead of just having 20 copies of the latest release, which was all they were willing to buy when a new release came out, what if they could just record and create whatever inventory they wanted, record over whatever movie was on a tape, and have 600 copies of a new release on Friday night?
It's a good idea.
I thought it was great. I was excited about it. this was long, obviously, before the internet and Netflix and things like that. But I went and tried to raise money. I had incredible advisors at Stanford who were, now I look back and I just think, I cannot believe, you know, people from Wilson Sonsini and people from...
Which is the law firm that took Apple public.
Yeah.
I mean, the respected technology law firm.
I got to meet and sit with people that I had no I didn't even know who they were. I had no business getting to do that, but great mentors helped make it possible. And in the end, they did not say it to my face, but what they were really telling me was, we don't believe you have the experience or the ability to go get this thing done, even if they loved the idea. That was a painful lesson. And by the way, I've had so many lessons like that throughout time. The first company that I really did make real and raised money for, the board eventually said, hey, you know, we're going to bring in a real CEO, someone who has industry experience and blah, 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 blah. And I thought, you know,
it's
damn
painful.
You.
It's painful.
So painful.
Yeah.
And it's happened other times. You learn a lot from the things you didn't do well enough and therefore failed at. And I expect to keep doing that my whole life. I just hope I fail at new things all the time and don't fail over and over at the same things.
That's a good goal. You know, sometimes you see that early lack of success derail people. What do you think it was that allowed you to pick up the pieces and say, okay, they're not saying no, they're saying not now.
Yeah.
You know, and I have to go get these experiences until I can do what I want.
Yeah. I do believe that a most fundamental characteristic of an entrepreneur, someone who really goes and builds something, is this this ability to turn no into something productive. Because the reality is, if you're trying to build something that has not existed before, if you're trying to do something new and different, you will hear no all the time, all the time. People won't agree to come and work for you. People will not agree to give you money. People will tell you it's not a good idea. People will tell you they won't buy it. People will on and on and on. Your life is full of no all the time. And either you genuinely absorb those no's and you learn from them and you turn them into people getting the yes, or they demotivate you and they say, ugh. And I know lots and lots of people who, when they get to know, it does change their course in such a fundamental way. They don't go on. It's just it takes too much energy to battle the no's all day, every day.
Grab those folks at that point where they're piecing, and it gets you at your core when you experience something like this. And there are some pivotal moments, I think, some of my advisors that were able to kind of say the right thing at the right time, that helped me reframe things and gave me the courage to just try one more time. I mean, Thomas Edison says, there's a quote, I'm paraphrasing it, but the greatest way to ensure success is to try just one more time.
Yeah.
And I love that quote. And sometimes all it takes is something like that to reset. So if you were talking to somebody that had experienced some like that, what do you think you'd share with them to maybe help him or her put that in perspective?
Yeah, I wish I had some magic pearl. There is a strength in no.
You have a lot of pearls, by the way.
There is a strength and a value in no, and recognize it. No is not, in so many circumstances, yes is the best, you think, but no is really, really good. You don't learn that much from yes. You learn a heck of a lot from no. Maybe is maybe the most debilitating thing. And yet people gravitate a lot toward maybe. Like really specifically, if you've been out raising money, I've been out raising money, we've had times in our careers when we've asked people for money and basically what they say is maybe. You've had a good meeting. We know sellers, people who sell for a living, and young sellers are always it was a great meeting. It was so fun. They were so engaged. Well, did they say yes? Did they buy? No, but we've got another good meeting, an AGM seller coming up. We gravitate toward maybe. No is a lot more valuable than maybe. And start to genuinely learn from and take energy from no.
So let's talk about what you did. So you had an idea for a company while you were in business school, tried to raise some money. It was too early to do that. What did you decide to do after business school?
So actually, I went and ran a U.S. Senate campaign right after business school in the 1992 cycle for a Democratic candidate here in Utah, Doug Anderson. This was after business school.
I didn't know that.
I had no business doing it, but it was incredibly valuable learning experience. It was the year, you wouldn't remember. It was the year that a longtime Utahan would remember was the year that Jake Garn retired, and in any case, we didn't win. It's hard to be a Democratic candidate in Utah, but. In any case, I did that for a little while.
It's very hard. were you thinking if he had won that you'd have a life in politics?
No, I didn't. I didn't know enough. I had really, really never thought about...
Your undergrad's in political science, right?
Some interest, but at Dartmouth, where I went to college, it was that particular degree was really a way to get a very broad exposure to so much of Dartmouth, political science, philosophy, history, economics, a lot of good, interesting stuff. It was not a means to think, oh, I might have a career in politics someday at all for me. That particular campaign, Doug, who's a very, very bright guy and whom I respected a lot as that young person, came and said, hey, look, no one's won in Utah as a Democrat. We're not going to do this with the standard inside group. You've got motivation. You have studied political science, you've got organizational skills, come do this with me.
That was a very risky move right out of business school.
Apparently too risky for him because it didn't work out so well in the end. But.
Well, the likelihood of a Democrat becoming a senator in the state of Utah is a very long shot.
Yeah.
Coming out of Stanford Business School is a very special time in your life, right? Yeah. There's a lot of doors that open. There's a lot of opportunities that are open as a graduating individual through the program, as opposed to somebody a year or two out.
Yeah.
How did you think about the trade-offs there?
Not deeply enough, probably. But I wanted to build things. I wanted to build a company. I'd really just been told, it had just become clear to me that this company I was trying to build wasn't going to become real. So it wasn't apparent to me what I was going to do next. I was going to go look for a new company. And Doug was very passionate about, hey, let's go make a difference. And we are doing ourselves a disservice as a state not to have a broader representation of voices. Let's go change that. And I frankly found that very, very appealing. It was less about like, hey, what are all the alternatives? Though, of course, some of that goes on. And it was like, hey, you could make a real difference.
It's important that both parties have viable candidates that have a vision, that offer voters a choice.
Yeah, I felt that really strongly at that time. And I still feel like that's the case even to this day, that we do ourselves a disservice as a state to not have some more balanced representation, better arguments that get to the crux of the issue, those kinds of things. But in any case, it was almost frivolous in some sense now, also, that I look back on that and I did that for a moment. It was never my long-term path or anything like that. I wanted to build technology companies.
And so how did that process begin? After the political campaign, what did you do next?
So really fixated on that right after the political campaign, and campaigns are by definition relatively short things. So right after that, and found some great technology that was being developed at BYU that modeled hearing, connected with some people out of Caltech, a very famous pioneer in silicon chip design, Carver Mead, and my dad, who was a signal processing genius, and worked to put together a company called Sonic Innovations to build a new, much better type of hearing device. And we built that company and started it up and raised several million dollars to go build it. And that really was the first step along the path of let's go build a real company.
And did you get to work closely with your father?
Yeah, for a minute. Sadly, he's passed away, and totally unbeknownst to me or anyone at the time, he was suffering, was starting to suffer from early onset Alzheimer's. So I had a wonderful moment to work with him, but he was not, it didn't work for long, unfortunately.
So, you know, it's not often that when somebody says, I had a chance to work with a genius, my father, that the term a genius would be an understatement. In your father's case, that's truly the case.
He was an absolutely remarkable
human.
Folks,
he was truly a pioneer. He came up with the first way to digitize sound.
That's exactly right.
He was 20, 30 years ahead of his time, and also, I believe, was instrumental in starting the computer science program here at the University of Utah.
That's right.
Oftentimes in technology, you find this. I mean, there's just this breakthrough. I mean, imagine what the internet would look like, or more importantly, what the internet would sound like, if we hadn't figured out how to digitize sound, right? But yet it took 20 or 30 years for that really to have its killer application and to become ingrained in everyday life. So here was a technology that was 30 years ahead of its time. And there's a lot of internet companies that are great ideas, but were way too far ahead of their time.
Yep.
As you kind of looked at the internet landscape and thought about your internet career, did your father's path, did that influence the way you looked at technology at all?
Well, he certainly influenced my overall path. It was literally a dinner conversation once upon a time where he had been working on digitization technologies and building a company. And he sat at the dinner table and said, in no way that he intended to be particularly profound, that he thought there were a lot of great engineers, a lot of great technologies being built in the world, and not enough people to turn those into real products and real value and real businesses. And that was a lightning bolt moment for me that made me think, that is what I want to do. I'm never going to be the genius engineer that my dad is, but I could do that. I could help with that, maybe. So that there's that level of it. And then something actually interesting to me that I'm maybe only realizing now in my life, and that is that fundamentally good ideas have a very, very long life. Like an idea starts to form many, many, many years before it may become very real and at scale. And I watch a lot of companies and entrepreneurs and other people either focus on ideas that they'll only be a good idea for a few months. It's a fine idea, but it's not really a long-term idea. Or I watch people give up on or be forced out of things that actually will take many, many, many years to become real. Frankly, experticity is kind of like that. There is no magic switch that we can turn on to create something instantly, but we'll transform commerce for a decade. And there are nuggets of the idea we're working on that they just take time. They take execution and time and building on. And I think it's true of many transformational things.
You know, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more with Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the local shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity. Tell us what CitySearch did and how you guys were able to succeed in a field that was so fraught with failures.
Yeah. You know, the fact is CitySearch wasn't that successful. I mean, it survives. It exists. But we raised a lot more money than we made. We spent more than we made. And that's really how it wound up continuing to exist. We had a lot of great people, incredible people. If you were to go back and do the family tree of CitySearch, like who started there and what have they gone on to do, it's absolutely shocking where those people have gone and the companies they've gone on to build. So great success in that way. But just as an entity, we believe City Search was going to completely replace the Yellow Pages, completely replace like City Weekly type magazines, event type focus, local information, completely replace classifieds. And we were going to do it all in 2 years. It just made so much sense to us that it was so much, it was such a better medium, the internet, that where you didn't have to publish once a week and have that information stay static.
You know, my company that I tried to raise money for in business school that I ultimately was not able to succeed in doing, in a period where if you had an internet idea, this was 1995, you got funded.
Yeah.
And I was able to get in front of Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins and Wilson Sonsini was my attorney as well, great advisor. My idea was a local play. And to Kleiner Perkins' credit, they're like, look, it's a great idea, but you're at least a decade too early, maybe 20 years. And, you know, people forget, Microsoft had a big venture trying to break local as well.
Sidewalk,
exactly.
We bought them.
and you were able to buy them because it wasn't going so well for
Microsoft.
That's
exactly right.
It's a very difficult...
We were able to buy it because they wanted to get rid of it. They left the negotiation laughing. So
it's a really difficult space. And as you say, it's such a better medium than what we have out there. Why do you think it's been such a tough nut to crack?
Oh, there are so many reasons. You got to get the right blend of traffic and eyeballs and functionality and real value and just it's taken long or it hasn't happened in the right way in many ways, but it's happened in brilliant ways. You know, you've heard me tell the story, I think, of sitting. We bought a company with a great brand name, Match.com, but not a very good technology, and a company with a better technology, one and only, and put them together and called it Match.com. And we would go to investors and to people and say, hey, we think this is a game changer. You have a much bigger pool. You can match people. You can all these great things. And they say, okay, well, the whole market for the whole market for personals in the newspaper in the whole country is only maybe $200 million. What fraction of that do you think you're going to be able to capture? And we would say, we think this is so fundamentally better that all by itself, it's going to be bigger than the whole $200 million market. And people would laugh at us, absolutely laugh at us. Like, you guys are so naive, you're so kidding yourself. Well, of course, it was much bigger. We were as big as the entire industry in 2.5 years. So some of it went incredibly well. Some of it went incredibly well. But that notion of the yellow pages and things like that, it's a really tough problem. And Google, no one uses the yellow pages anymore. The yellow pages is dead, but the advertising model is different. And the way we use Google or another search function to figure out what's nearby, what's open, where should we go? Google would say local is still one of their toughest challenges. But boy, are they solving it in brilliant ways, and they're spending lots of money doing it. And
I hope you in the audience will forgive me. I'm kind of meandering a little bit, but you're opening up really rich discussions here, and I want to kind of go with the flow there. I want to go back to Sonic Innovation.
Yeah.
I did, in prep for this interview, I've known who your father was for a long time, been a big fan of what he's done. But I hadn't done any research, and one of the things I saw was your father actually did commercialize this digital sound. His first machines in the mid-70s sold for $160,000. Mm-hmm. In today's dollars, that's $750,000 to digitize music, to put it in a format that nobody had a player to play.
That's exactly right.
$750,000, and great, you've got digital sound, but nobody can play it.
Yeah, it was only to make recordings in studios and edit in studios, and there was a rush to figure out, could there be a consumer format?
And you know, that's one of the things that amazes me about technology. I think we all, over the short period of time, think, well, in 3-4 years, like I was thinking for internet local idea that I had, in 3 or 4 years, we're going to be here. And I think we overestimate where we're going to be over a short period of time, but we underestimate where we're going to be in 15 or 20 years.
That's exactly right.
In sonic innovation, to think about this desktop digital editing system that costs in today's dollars $750,000, fast forward 10 years, 15 years later, and you can put this technology in a hearing aid that fits in somebody's ear, is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. It never ceases to amaze me. Yeah. So Soundstream, which was Dad's company, the pioneer of digital audio, which existed in the 70s and into the early 80s, and that technology, I still have those original machines, by the way, and it is mind-bending that there's way...
I hate to break it to you. They're not worth $750,000 anymore.
No, they're worth a lot more than that to my sentimental self,
yes.
But no one's going to buy them. In any case, those things now are sitting, there are, in fact, sitting in front of us right here in this radio studio, there are 8 or 10 of them in a little mixed deck right here. So it's just amazing to think about. And there's no tape anywhere. So I don't see any of it spinning on the walls.
And as you were looking at the landscape, so you did a political campaign after business school, your next company was Sonic Innovation. How important was it to you to play a role in commercializing your father's technology?
Not that, you know, it was a wonderful possible dream. How cool would that be to get to work with Dad on something for some period of time? But it was never, it wasn't the core thing. It wasn't the thing I was trying to do. I was trying to do the more fundamental thing. Could I be the business leader of technology companies? That was more fundamentally what I was focused on. And then Sonic Innovations, the internet seems so much more exciting. In those mid-90s, Netscape was becoming real, and Jim Clark, who had worked here in Utah and was a family friend, was working
Netscape on... Netscape and Silicon Graphics.
He had been the head at Silicon Graphics, and he was helping Mark Andreessen start Netscape, and that went public. And it just seemed to me like the internet was going to be cool and new and interesting, and hearing aids weren't. And some friends of mine called me people I'd worked with in Boston a few years earlier said, "Hey, we're thinking about doing this thing. We're gonna kill the yellow pages. We're gonna do this stuff, and our computer models keep telling us that Salt Lake City is the right place. It's got high internet penetration, an educated workforce, a high concentration of small businesses. Does that seem right to you?" And yeah, and let's go get it done. And so we started City Search in Salt Lake and a couple other cities.
You know, you mentioned that they raised a lot of money, and it ultimately was not a huge, it was a success, not a huge success. It did sell to Barry Diller's company.
Yeah.
You ended up being president of Ticketmaster, yeah. Which was one under the Barry Diller empire. For folks that don't know, Barry Diller is one of the internet franchise success stories.
Yeah.
Kind of has the magic touch. He's also known to be a very difficult person to work for.
Yeah.
What lessons about running a business did you learn from Barry Diller?
So Barry Diller, and he, a whole bunch of things. So he was exceptionally creative. He really is the person who pioneered the notion of a mini series, right? As a very young guy, he was working at a network that did not exist yet, essentially Fox. And in any case, he did a bunch of remarkable things to pioneer media more broadly. And he could look at any given piece of creative or something you'd present on the internet or a piece of marketing material or things like that. And he was a creative genius, but he was an absolutely horrible manager. Absolutely, totally disrespectful, disempowering, just created a lot of anger and angst among people who were trying to go build something and then, you know, would get second-guessed about a pixel.
Did he know this about himself?
I think he became increasingly self-aware of that. He got a lot more criticism about it over time. I think his early career was full of people just saying, "You're a genius." And his later career, as he started to try and invest in companies and buy and build and whatever, was a lot of, "Get out of the way. You're really screwing this up." But he's he still has been very successful, and he's a brilliant guy. He can be incredibly difficult to work with, and yes, there are a lot of stories about that, but a lot of great about him too, and a lot to learn from him. He helped, you know, he did help fund a lot of, I mean, we bought, with his money, we bought Expedia. With his money, we bought Hotels.com. With his money, we bought a bunch of things that have wound up being incredible investment success, incredible internet businesses. We used City Search money that we had raised to buy Match.com. And we made a deal with Ticketmaster, which he was buying. He owned at the time, which was, hey, we'll do the internet. We'll start selling tickets on the internet, which not that many tickets were being sold on the internet at the time, a couple $100,000 a month on AOL. We'll take all those internet rights to sell tickets, and if it's successful, you will wind up with a much bigger stake in City Search, an equity stake. And in fact, we sold so many tickets on the internet, it's just mind-bending.
It's a brilliant idea, but it wasn't obvious at the time that people would do that.
Well, in fact, if you were in the ticketing business, it seemed impossible. It seemed wrong that people would do that. It just, people want to stand in line at the stores. There's all sorts of dynamics that are true in ticketing, that perception of a line is a critical part of what actually sells the tickets and creates the mystique around an event or a concert. In any case, time has proven that it works really well to sell tickets on the internet. But those were and are fun times. And really, if I look back on it, there were lots and lots of successful companies, but a lot of really remarkable people that came out of that and did amazing things.
We unfortunately need to let you go. I know you've got a commitment right after this, but it's been wonderful talking with you. It's been wonderful being your friend over the past couple decades, and it's been a lot of fun watching what you've built and the impact you've had here in Utah.
Well, thank you so much.
Our guest this morning has been Tom Stockham, the CEO of Experticity. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear my entire interview with Tom on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.